Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology and faculty associate in law and public affairs.
So, Sam, the 100 days of President Trump are coming to a close.
The first 100 days
and, another 100 are to come. This has been a concept we've used now for a long time to talk about presidents. We evaluate and grade them, or some people do, in terms of how much legislation they get through Congress, how their approval ratings are doing, and how they look in front of the media and in front of Capitol Hill. Most agree that in terms of legislation, President Trump hasn't had the best time. His major piece of legislation, health care, failed, and his approval ratings are not much to speak about. Others note that he's doing all right. A lot of executive actions have gone through. He's taken some steps on foreign policy, including the strike against Syria, and he continues to have strong poll approval with the base. So today, to talk about the 100 days, the first 100 days, why we have this concept and how President Trump is doing with some historical perspective, we're delighted to have Meg Jacobs, political historian right here at Princeton, who will walk us through a little bit of the history and her thoughts on how President Trump compares to some of the other people who have led this country. Meg is one of the nation's leading political historians. She's the author of the award-winning pocketbook Politics, Economic Citizenship in the 20th Century America, co-author of Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, and most recently the author of Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. She's currently at work on a new book with Viking on the history of the New Deal and World War II. And for the purposes of full disclosure, Meg is my wife. So it's a very special episode, a family episode of Politics and Polls. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dad.
So maybe we can begin just by asking why we have this idea of the 100 days and kind of where it comes from and why it's been used.
Well, the 100 days, as you know, is most closely associated with Franklin Roosevelt, who came into office after the election of 1932, which was the low point of the Great Depression of the 1930s, one in four Americans out of work. And Roosevelt comes into office, and in order to rescue the nation, to lift it out of this crisis, he passes a flurry of legislation in what we now call the first 100 days, everything from banking reform to agricultural reform, industrial recovery, public works, TVA. It was this blast of legislation that has really set the benchmark for presidents ever since.
And this legislation, so today supporters of President Trump will say, well, he still has signed a lot of legislation. The kind of legislation—
Wait, do we call this legislation?
Yeah.
We're talking about actual laws.
Bills. I think 28 or something. But,
okay, right.
But the kind of bills, Meg, that you're talking about with FDR, those were different in scale and scope than a lot of what we see in most presidencies.
And in ambition. The purpose of the Roosevelt's 100 days was to dramatically expand the powers and influence of the federal government and to allow it to intervene deeply into the American economy in a way that it had not before. In some ways, Donald Trump has the exact opposite ambition. So to the extent that whether you call them pieces of legislation or bills or low profile measures he has signed, whatever the catchy phrase you want to use, the purpose of Trump's 100 days of these pieces of bills has been to scale back government, to really sort of do the opposite of what Roosevelt was doing.
So Roosevelt's executive orders were big. They were things like, I'm looking at one now, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, which you cited. It's entitled A Suggestion for Legislation to Create the Tennessee Valley Authority. That's very coy, a suggestion. But did it end up being what he suggested?
Yeah, and more. The thing that I actually think, let me just start by revealing my thoughts. I actually think that the FDR comparison is apt in that legislation is one way of measuring it, but just in terms of an agenda, the use of sort of executive power, the ambition of what you want to do as president, there are some similarities, and no one was bolder than FDR. And, you know, the things that he did now, I mean, if we sort of think that Trump has sort of operated outside of the law, FDR really threw out the book. I mean, he said as he took the oath of office that he wanted broad executive powers as if we were in a war. And he followed through on that.
Well, but to link it back to, let me think here. So I guess 100 days would be then, therefore, the setting of a tone where it's what an administration would like to be. And whether they get there or not, then it's setting a tone. And in Roosevelt's case, it was the first of about, 13 years or 12 and a half years of being president and reshaping what the presidency meant and reshaping, I think we talked about it on this program before, the concept of constitutional hardball, where the relationship between the president and the other branches of government was changed by Roosevelt.
Absolutely.
Okay, so are we saying that Trump, A, wants to do that, or B, he's gotten there?
Well, I mean, one thing that's similar between the two, actually, is they both had the benefit of ruling with unified government. So, you know, when Roosevelt came in, there was Democratic Congress, the same thing with Trump. I would say that it's certainly not been the case that Trump is in the driver's seat, the same way that we could talk about Roosevelt being in the driver's seat. But it's not clear exactly where he wants to drive. It's not clear
he that— He wants to be in the driver's seat, though.
He definitely wants to be in the driver's seat.
That's what he likes. Yeah,
you know, and that's his goal. That's his ambition. And he is there. I mean,
you know
he is in the driver's seat.
You know what you call somebody who's in the driver's seat but doesn't quite know where to go?
No.
That's an Uber driver.
But why? But you think there's more similarities than people think. So many people are cynical when you hear the FDR comparison. A lot of people are like, you know, back up. This is not FDR. And right now they'll say, well, he doesn't have a single bill. You just pointed to some kind of transformative legislation. Can you like talk a little bit about why you think there's more there to the comparison than people might think?
Well, okay. I don't want to go too far because then I sort of set myself up, you know, to say like, really? You know, that's a silly comparison.
Yep.
But there are certainly ways that Trump has been innovative. And some of the ways in which he's been innovative do harken back to things that FDR did. So, for example, Trump's relationship with the press, if you want to call it a relationship, I mean, his complete sort of contempt of the press, that might be a better characterization of it. But regardless of how you characterize
FDR didn't like the press.
FDR didn't like the press, but regardless of how you characterize Trump's feelings about the press, he's been quite savvy and innovative in how he uses the media to reach out to his base. And of course, FDR did that too. FDR was most famously remembered for his fireside chats. We can really sort of think of FDR as the first social media president in a certain kind of way.
Fireside tweets.
But they were radical and innovative, and they were designed because, as you mentioned, Julian, FDR, you know, the press, FDR perceived the press to be partisan. FDR perceived the press to be against him, that, you know, large parts of it, like the Chicago Tribune, were quite conservative. And so that the idea was with the fireside chats, he would reach directly out to the American public and in a way mobilize them to put pressure on Congress and go outside of the press.
My understanding of what in the long arc Roosevelt accomplished was getting back to this constitutional hardball idea that there are these times in U.S. history. Now I'm here in front of two people who know so much more about history than I do, but
there's going to be a quiz later. So yeah.
I've got a pen. My pen is actually erasable, so I can change my answers, which is good. But there are times when these relationships change. So before Roosevelt, Congress was strong, proposed legislation, and the president kind of went along with that. And then after Roosevelt, there was a much more muscular executive where then the president proposed things like this business about suggesting the Tennessee Valley Authority. He suggested it, but it came into being. And so that was an example of strengthening the presidency. Now, it's certainly true that Trump wants to change things, but he doesn't necessarily have control over what direction the change is going to be. It could be that the presidency will become weaker as a consequence. He doesn't want it to become weaker, but one could imagine a large change simply by virtue of the fact that he's a disruptive presence and therefore some other branch of government will step in, like maybe the judiciary. Maybe it'll become a more dominant branch now that Congress doesn't have its act together and the president's executive orders seem to be, you know, in many cases, not really going anywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could. I mean, it is easy, right, to characterize his 100 days as a failure, right?
And that was my thought.
Yeah, so it is, and you know, you mentioned the court, and the courts have intervened and given him setbacks. So, you know, with the travel bans, for example, you know, he's faced a lot of resistance and you know, been stalled in his tracks in many ways. And obviously, it would have been better for him if that did not happen. Whether or not that was a big political failure, I think, is a separate question.
Well, I guess we find out in the next 100 days and the 100 days after that.
Can I ask, I'll get back to Trump in a second, to President Trump. Do you even, I wrote something that I'm not convinced that the 100 days is a useful standard. And we use it, and it's understandable why. I think we use it from my perspective. It's easy for reporters to talk about it. It's neat. It's something you can measure. FDR set this incredible standard. So when a president does that, you want to measure everyone who comes after.
You know when your deadline is on your story.
You know when your deadline is on. No, it creates a framework in a messy political process. Do you? I mean, where are you on? I don't even know. Where are you on using the 100 days as a benchmark? Is it just kind of routine now? Or do you think it's still valuable?
I think it's useful, but not necessarily in the ways you talked about. I mean, you know this as an expert on Lyndon Johnson. I mean, political timing matters, right? So it's not just a sort of convention that makes it easy to give him a grade. But when you assume office, you come in with lots of political capital. You have a honeymoon period. You get to sort of set your agenda. So you get to choose what is at the top of your agenda, and you get to do so at a moment before you have to start worrying immediately about midterms and your reelection. So I think it's still useful in that way, just in the sense of political timing.
You think you are, so back to President Trump, in these, what do we have, we have 100 days on Saturday, I believe. Do you think he has failed or struggled as much as many people think? We've had many people on the show who, by and large, don't think, whether they like him or don't like him, that he is successful. He's had many problems. His approval ratings are abysmal nationally. He seems to be struggling.
Lowest in the history of polling.
Do you kind of look back at these 100 days and see that story?
Lowest in the history of polling.
In his presidency, he's the least popular of any president since in modern polling, so going back to Eisenhower.
And what about his base?
This is an interesting question. It's been there's been news in the last week or so that he is apparently strong with his base, with that one poll suggests 84% of his base approves of him. But, you know, there's a problem with that information, and that's who's the base. So if you're disaffected from your party's president and you answer a pollster, do you say that you're a member of their party? You might say, you know, so are you a Republican? Well, I was a Republican, but I'm certainly not now. And so one difficulty with these is that partisan affiliation is self-reported. So I actually am somewhat doubtful as to whether we know whether he's still strong with his base, because what we don't have is longitudinal data where you take the same people and follow them over and over again and say, okay, you told us you were a Democrat or a Republican in January. Now, do you approve of him? And that's separating self-identification from approval, I think, is important. And I think no one's done that.
Go to it, Sam.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, I can't speak to any of that with any kind of expertise, but it is significant, especially in an age of polarization, that there are polls out there in which he actually is popular.
Yeah, he's still at... At least as reported, he's at 84% among self-reported Republicans.
I don't think that that's the only metric, but I think that's not an unimportant one for President Trump, who very much cares about his popularity. And he does not care about his popularity among the broad electorate. He cares about his popularity among those whom he perceived to be his base. So in that sense, many of the things that he's done have not been orchestrated in order to sort of bring about long-term reform or substantive change, but to satisfy his constituents or his perceived constituents. So whether the travel ban works or not, he did it. Whether or not he repealed Obamacare, he supported it. So he, you know, and then there's things that he's actually done, like he got a Supreme Court justice onto the bench. Obama didn't do that. That's pretty big. And that's something that will actually have long-term consequences.
Obama didn't have a vacancy that arose during the Bush administration.
Well, we can qualify it all you want, but I'm saying, you know, in the grand, in the big picture, long-term perspective of things, he's done stuff, and everything was set up for him to do it. He got his cabinet members approved. And, you know, all, there was all this talk about sort of, you know, opposition. That didn't happen. He has acted as a commander in chief. You could disagree with, you know, his use of military force, but he has projected this image of strength. He, you know, followed through on the TPP. You know, he's done things. He's not just bumbled along.
But 80% of nominees that require Senate confirmation have no nomination at all. So it may be that he has cabinet heads, but there are reports in the news that there are cabinet heads who are complaining about having no deputies, having no people below them. They have to rely on career government employees or holdovers from the previous administration to get their job done. So in fact, the basic job of running a federal government seems to be lacking nominations.
But again, I mean, I think this is, and maybe this is where you were going to, Julian, you know, it depends what your metric is. So if we move from FDR to Ronald Reagan, who had ambitions that I think are more closely aligned with what Trump is trying to do, the whole point was to sort of gut from within. So there's no way you could undo the environmental legislation of the 1970s. There was no way Reagan was going to do that, and he didn't even have unified government to do that. But you could slash the EPA budget. You could put people, you know, in top at the top. James Watt, the Secretary of the Interior, was called the unenforcer. So, you know, you could sort of set that agenda from the top that kind of guts from within. And that's consistent. So you might be right and you might be wishing that government, you know, would operate with efficiency, but it might match Trump's goals to actually have vacancies.
So you, well, you wrote an article about that, and you kind of argue this was a more deliberate strategy than people think. And that was early on. That was as the presidency began. And you put it in this history of Reagan, including Ann Gorsuch, this kind of starving the beast from within regulatory agencies. So you see part of what's
Neil Gorsuch's mother.
Yeah, Neil Gorsuch's mother. And the James Watt story is probably the most famous. Clarence Thomas heads the EEOC, even though he says openly, I'm not in favor of affirmative action and I'm not going to do anything to enforce this. So you see this as a deliberate strategy, what's going on. This is a conservative tactic that we have seen. You saw it in Richard Nixon to some extent as well, didn't you?
Well, it's a longstanding conservative tactic in the age of big government. So, you know, despite Reagan's famous inaugural adage in 1981, government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem, we've seen that, you know, since then government has continued to grow and expand. So the question is, if you're sort of hostile to the, you know, using federal power in particular ways, particularly to regulate the economy, how do you soften that regulatory power? And so what we've seen from Nixon to Reagan to Bush and now with Trump is sort of, as you say, sort of starving the beast, sort of gutting from within. And so in that sense, you know, Julian and I have disagreements. We don't agree on everything. And one of our points of disagreement is, well, from the very beginning, I believed everyone was counting Trump out too soon, from the very beginning. So I was a very, very early proponent of the idea that Trump had political legs, and that was, and he was going someplace. I made money off of that, and Julian got to eat a nice dinner because I bet my friends and won the bet. So I end up maybe overstating the case that there's a sort of deliberate strategy behind everything that Trump is doing, and Julian's less inclined to sort of see it that way.
But who's the mastermind there, Trump?
Well, I don't know that he's a mastermind, right? So I wouldn't go that far.
Bannon?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but it's not just that. It's sort of a legacy of kind of, you know, party stalwarts, too, that he has around him, you know, who understand that it's tough to get legislation through. And so, you know, if you think about someone like David Stockman, who is the head of Reagan's OMB, you know, he came from the Hill. And he was the guy, you know, who took an axe to the federal budget. And I think the thing that is most interesting that I think we're waiting for is to see, and I think today is the day when we're going to get some more details on it, is what Trump—
As we record this, what's happening right now, the government shutdown. So there has to be a budget. And so what we're waiting for is the possibility that there may be a government shutdown on the 101st day.
Right? I don't think there will be, though. I think that's pretty much resolved. But the tax cut is coming now.
But there's no legislation.
Right. But he put out the proposal today.
Today.
He's cutting corporate taxes from
30 to 15.
The initial reaction from the Hill has been pretty tepid. I mean, Paul Ryan's chief of staff was not very positive about it. Orrin Hatch kind of rained on it a little bit. So it hasn't really gotten such a warm reception. And that cool reception has happened in public. So that's not exactly a great start.
No. But, you know, I mean, if you look back to Reagan, the main accomplishment of more than the first 100 days of Reagan, I can't do the math, Sam, but August. So what do we have from January to August, Sam? How many days is that?
I don't know, 10 or 20.
Okay.
About 200.
Okay. So, you know, so the main achievement, which, by the way, happens in part, this is going to sound more coarse than I intended to, but happens in part because of the assassination attempt on Reagan, which sort of gives him all this sort of renewed credibility and standing and popularity. His main signal accomplishment, which occurs in August, is the passing of his budget and tax cut. That's what it is. So
it's worth remembering. I mean, the tax cut, Sam, was actually pretty controversial when it starts, too. A lot of Republicans don't want to do it. They say it's going to increase the deficit. The spending cuts that are associated with it are going nowhere. So I think that's actually accurate. And it turns out to be the most successful part, really, of his domestic policy. So the grumbling on the Hill, I'm not sure kind of how long that lasts, especially as a lot of businesses are going to be licking their chops.
Wall Street's ecstatic.
Because the Republican agenda is to cut taxes. And if that gets through, I see. Because if you look at Reagan, the deficit in Reagan's first year of office was apparently $79 billion. The next year is $128 billion. And then it was pretty routine to have close to $200 billion deficits.
Right. Yeah.
So that was evidently okay at that time.
Well, he makes it okay. Yeah. A lot of Republicans didn't want it. Can I turn to another issue that you've written about, which is a big one? He really cares about energy policy. This has been something I've been struck at how consistent it is. He has tried to deregulate energy markets. He talks about energy even in foreign policy. What's going on? Why is this so important to Trump, and what have we seen so far?
Well, to Sam's point, I don't know that he cares about energy policy. He cares about what he likes to call energy independence, because I think that that reinforces this kind of America first kind of macho, we don't get pushed around. And it's true. One of the things that he's consistently talked about, so if you look at his interviews going back to the 1980s, after the 1970s energy crisis, is America should never be sort of held hostage again. And he's always been really stuck on that issue. And so early on, he looked to the council. He looked to people like Harold Hamm and sort of important energy businessmen to sort of give him guidance. And it's something that really sort of brought together a lot of different things wrapped into one that Trump liked. He likes coal. He likes to tell coal miners, you know, I'm going to save your jobs. That's something he likes. He's not really particularly interested. That might be an understatement or a euphemistic or just wrong. He doesn't care about climate change, you know, so he is able to sort of use the sort of embrace of oil and coal as a way to sort of repudiate and mock people who are worried and focused on climate change. And it makes him sort of look muscular to sort of say we're going to be independent and we won't have to sort of be at the behest of Middle East sheiks to go begging for their oil. So it sort of wraps into the image that Trump likes to project.
There aren't that many coal miners left.
Yeah, but he likes to talk about them a lot. So,
sure.
He signed some piece of legislation, some executive order the other day, and he said, you know, he did this in front of a bunch of coal miners, and he just sort of can hold it up. And he says, you know what this is, right? This is getting your jobs back. I don't even remember the specifics of what it was doing, but it sort of works to this idea that he's the great savior and, you know, he's sort of macho and preserving macho jobs, and we're sort of asserting American virility and strength. So
there's what? There's a few hundred thousand coal miners in America?
There's more people employed in the solar industry than in the coal mining industry.
Well, we just had a march for science last weekend around the country and around the world. 20 times as many scientists and engineers in the United States as coal miners.
Yeah.
So the coal miners, that's not exactly a big demographic.
Well, again, that's why I said to Julian, it's not symbolic. Really about policy. Yeah, it's okay. About politics.
But it's also important. I mean, a lot of the conservative donors, like the Koch brothers, are remarkable. They're very interested in deregulating energy markets. Mm-hmm. So I assume this appeals to the traditional Republican base, even though we're always talking about him as this kind of outlier, an eccentric maverick. In some ways, this is what you had with Bush. Didn't George W. Bush kind of have a similar impetus?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a high priority for very rich, influential lobbyists in Washington, sort of deregulating energy markets, which could include everything from undercutting Obama's clean power plan to authorizing the Keystone and Dakota pipelines. And it can satisfy it politically, it works. And I think in terms of pleasing important constituents, it works too.
I mean, so there's a way to see the 100 days of President Trump, useful or not as a concept, where subtly he's actually, even with these polls, he's taking some steps that a lot of Republicans can see as positive, whether you're talking about Koch brother business Republicans who really are thirsting for this kind of deregulation, to basically bringing any kind of legislation to a standstill is not necessarily bad if you're a conservative, and kind of even backing away some of his more controversial foreign policies, including on relations with China. There are elements in which, even with these approval ratings, it's possible to see, whether strategic or not,
So this is more in the category of getting policy objectives without legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's not at all clear that there's going to be any kind of real landmark legislation appearing in the next year or two.
Except for possibly tax cut.
Possibly, although I think I need to see evidence for that. Because I think the one thing that may be true about the first 100 days is that they set the stage for the next 100 days in the sense that Clinton is said to have had a bad 100 days.
Right.
But then the Clinton administration regrouped and figured out how to get through the next 100 days. And so there was a real interest in governing, and there was a real interest in using that first 100 days to set the tone for the next 100 days. So do we see evidence that these first 100 days are a period of learning in which people who work for the Trump administration have learned from what happened in order to get better outcomes for the next 100 days?
Well, one thing that will be sort of interesting, I mean, the larger context here is that Trump is governing in a period of relative stability. There are no sort of large crises here. So that's very different than when FDR took office, in which there was an imperative, you know, an absolute imperative to actually get stuff done when you had people hungry in the streets. You know, it's not clear what the sort of political impetus is behind sort of having a different 100, you know, second 100 days than the first one. I mean, it's not clear from a political point of view what it is that he would have to accomplish. I keep coming back to the tax cut because I actually think that that is substantively important to the Republican Party. And so I think that in a baseline way, that is something that they would like to be able to deliver on, both the White House and the Capitol, even if they have differing opinions about what that legislation looks like. But I'm not so sure what you would have to do differently. I mean, a thing that's kind of remarkable, here we are 100 days, you know, and he's president. And one of the things that
So he's ahead of William Harrison.
He's what?
He's the head of William Henry Harrison.
Yeah. But one of the things that's just kind of amazing, and this is the thing that I've been struck by about Trump from the very beginning, and this is just proven true. He's tremendously resilient. I mean, you know, the kinds of scandals that he has encountered within these 100 days, you know, is remarkable. And sort of there's, you know, liberals are sort of expectant, oh, well, you know, Moore's going to come out and Flynn has to step down and he's going to rat everyone. You know, none of this has happened. And so the fact that Trump is president and that has become sort of normalized, you know, people who, oh, there was also this, you know, idea, oh, he won't like being president. He wants to win, but then he'll step down. I mean, these were all sort of fantasies. So, you know, even the posing of the question, say, I'm like, will they learn for the second 100 days? You know, that already suggests a complete normalization of the Trump presidency. And in some ways, that's kind of a victory for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot there. I think the conversation's changed. We're debating policy now. We really are. People are debating what he's going to do, what he's not going to do. They're talking about behind-the-room struggles between advisors. That's kind of normal stuff at this point. And that's a change from when we were taping these shows in November and December, when the real question is, is this going to work? What's going to happen? And that shift is probably important politically. If you are a supporter of President Trump or you're a Republican, that's a big change in tone. And that gets us more to the area of partisanship, where more Republican voters, if this is somewhat stable and normal, might say, well, that's better than a Democrat. You know? What do you think of that, Sam? You're not convinced.
Not buying it. Yeah. You know, there's no real way to put lipstick on the pig that in the first 100 days there, you know, look, what got signed in the first 100 days of Obama's presidency? The Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act.
Yeah.
The stimulus package. Those things were on their way. The S-chip expansion or whatever, you know, these are things that happened in or near the first 100 days. And so there was actual movement on legislative priorities that were important to the Democrats.
Am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah.
I don't know what the protocol is. Sam, so regardless of whether you support Trump, what would it take for you to see that the first 100 days were in fact a success?
I would need to know what major priorities of Trump's campaign platform saw meaningful movement. And my recollection of the campaign was there was something about repealing Obamacare and there was something about building a wall. And I don't see any sign of action on that. And these were central promises that were made. So just stated objectively, if you had to like write down things that the guy wanted to do and compare them with what's happened in the last 100 days, I think it's a pretty unambiguous lack of movement. You know, it seems obvious to me. And so I'm kind of curious about – so yes, there are regulatory things that are being attempted at the EPA, but his own supporters seem to be somewhat skeptical about there being movement on that. In the domain of education, like it's sort of unclear what has happened in any sense. I mean, they have a Secretary of Education now. So I guess what I'm looking for here is some statement about exactly what did happen that was a stated priority beforehand.
But for example, and this is a policy I don't know much about, so let's just have at it and I'll state ignorance up front. But, you know, look at education, for example. You know, Reagan campaigned on, I'm going to get rid of the Department of Education. I'm going to get rid of the Department of Energy. You know, so the first guy that serves as his Secretary of Energy, James Edward, who was a former dentist, you know, he said, I'm going to work my way out of a job. That was the stated objective. And the Department of Energy existed, and that was large part because, you know, some substantial portion of their funds actually go towards the nuclear program. But with education, too, you know, there was not the removal of the Department of Education. So, you know, and for example, if you look at Betsy DeVos, you know, so she's a big proponent of charter schools. So that's been an objective of all Republican presidents to sort of push back on public school and promote charter schools. But how is this any less successful than any previous Republican president?
I mean, the question is also if the measure is just off. I mean, maybe this 100 days is just a bad idea to keep using. Why do we measure this period? Whether you think he's successful or not successful, there is an artificial element. There's, you know, Obama's signature legislation comes long after the 100 days. It's the health care bill. And, same with Reagan and the tax cut. Maybe we get locked up in this measure, historians, journalists, pundits, everyone, and it just doesn't tell us that much. And we also hold it to one standard. I mean, the standard is FDR. And that standard means lots of legislation. But maybe that's not what presidents need to do or fulfill campaign promises. I ask that in some ways as an open question, but we're kind of locked into that.
So if we take as the baseline time before the next election when Congress, all of the House and one-third of the Senate has to stand and face voters about what's gotten done. So at some level, the baseline is what can get done on that timescale. On that timescale, President Obama got the Affordable Care Act passed. On that timescale, you know, they kind of they took a bath on immigration, right? Like they had some difficulties, but they got this the single largest expansion in this, of federal government in decades. They got the single most redistributive piece of policy, where that was a redistribution of basically income from higher income to lower income people. I mean, it was a massive piece of redistribution. So that's now on the baseline of till the next election.
So the midterm election.
Yeah, till the midterm election. So now my take on that is, okay, fine. 100 days is artificial, but it sets the tone for the degree of competence with which those goals are achieved. And if legislative competence is not required to call a presidency a success, then I guess we're moving the goalpost to a place where you don't have to be able to get anything through Congress except for the tax cut. Is that the idea?
Well, let me also frame it differently, which is back to your area of expertise. I mean, one of the things that really cemented FDR's success and conversely questioned Reagan's success were the midterm elections. So the 34 midterm elections were unprecedented. That might be the wrong word, but were unusual in the sense that they broadened the Democratic majority, which was seen as a sort of affirmation of Roosevelt's leadership thus far. In 82, the story was very different and the Republicans suffered. So, you know, the question is, what are we looking at for the midterm elections? That is Trump, regardless of how we evaluate his success, whether it's through legislative competence or not, you know, will he be able to sort of sustain his governing majority?
I think at some level, it occurs to me that one of the problems.
Side to this too.
Yeah, one of the problems here is looking back and saying something is a success turns into an assertion of whether something was a success or not. So does this mean that we could come up with a set of things that could happen this calendar year or by early next year, and we would say if those things happen, then therefore Trump's administration would be considered relatively successful. And we could do it now on today as we're recording. This is April 26th. We could do this now and say, okay, if these things happen. So, for instance, gaining seats in the House.
Yeah.
Clear success.
Clear.
Okay. So,
clear.
If the Republican Party.
Write it down, Sam.
Gains seats in the House, because that's one.
Okay.
Right? Okay. Yeah. Getting a tax cut. That's another one?
Yeah, I think so.
What else do we have?
I would put that on the list. Well, I think you already did one too. I think you would say Gorsuch is a success.
Mm-hmm.
You're unhappy
that's
with that,
success.
But that's a
I agree.
Success.
That's a, I agree. That's
put
a
it
success.
On the list. Write it down, Sam.
Doesn't count because it's looking backwards.
Well, that's arbitrary.
You know, retaining support in the self-identified base and not losing enormous support from Republicans, meaning not that they don't like him, but they will actually vote Democratic
okay,
come
but there
2020.
You need to, but there you need to have some quantitative measure of whether the base is being measured properly.
No, right. But you're just asking kind of what would a measure be. I think that's fair because that's the strategy of the
election. Retained support and base. Although, doesn't every president retain his base? Like, didn't Obama retain his base?
Like he did. And
so
that
is there in an age of partisan polarization? Is there going to be somebody?
George H.W. Bush didn't.
That was before polarization.
But
really
that also, because it might be the norm doesn't mean it's unimportant. I mean, you know, especially with Trump, because the question is, he had all of these people who went towards him that weren't supposed to go towards him. So the question is, you know, did those, you know, tens of thousands of vote, do those tens of thousands of voters in Wisconsin and Michigan stick with him or not?
I think that's
important.
There's a flip side to all this, in that, you know, there's presidents who are very good in these 100 days period. Get a lot and they don't have a good outcome. So Lyndon Johnson had lots of legislation, both after he takes over and after he's reelected, from civil rights to Medicare and Medicaid, federal education, more. One-term president, doesn't even run a second time.
Carter.
Jimmy Carter, you read the press at the end of his first 100 days, his approval ratings are in the 60s. No, the first 100 days, he was doing great. The people were writing in the press, this is going to be a successful president. He has a good feel for the Democratic Party, united government, one-term president.
And disaster, does that, you know, by you know, a disastrous, you know, his approval ratings go lower than Nixon's when Nixon left office.
Right.
But if I'm following this, Johnson was a failure. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, but you can argue, yeah, politically. He doesn't.
In the 100 days.
Yeah, not in the 100 days.
His president, you're taking the position that there's a way to look at Johnson's presidency as a failure.
Many people do.
Okay, so Medicare, Medicaid, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act,
federal education.
Okay, these things are mostly with us. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of the balance is Vietnam.
Vietnam and one-term president.
Okay, so but the point is that
and the Democratic Party. This is Nixon wins in 1968, and you have the beginning of a fundamental realignment of American politics that leads us to Reagan, the Bushes, to today. And for Lyndon Johnson, who was a political creature who believed in the New Deal that Meg's talked about and the Democratic Party, that was a devastating outcome.
Okay, but that's a failure that senior citizens still have now. Poor Americans still have now. Voters who are non-white still have that now. So failure or not, those changes lasted for 50 years and appear to be sticking around.
Well, the question – I mean everything that we're saying comes down to the division between policy and politics. Things can be policy successes but political failures. And so what – so you could have Trump being a political success but a policy failure.
And, you know, to many supporters of his and many Republicans, the ramped up deportations, the deregulations we've been talking about are probably going to be seen as good. And if he get – there's still time to get tax cuts and even to weaken ACA, if not get rid of it. I wouldn't put that off. And if he does those things, Sam, for many conservatives, it would probably be seen in the same way that you're in the same light. You're talking about some of the great society.
Okay. Weaken the Affordable Care Act.
If not dismantle it altogether.
Well, what's the – where are we
– Boost military spending.
Okay. I'm just looking for a place to set the bar, looking forward and not looking backwards. Okay. So boosting military spending. So gain seats in the House in November 18, get a tax cut, boost military spending, keep his partisan support, although that's something that seems to be a standard feature of American life of the last several decades.
And right. But there's a negative. If he doesn't lose it, given who he was and all the – unorthodox nature, I think that's actually more than standard for him.
I see. Okay. So and boost military spending. So now we have a list of things that if they happen in the next year, one could consider his goals to have been met.
And then there's a big measure, obviously, 2020.
Oh, so, yeah. He's still going to be president then, right?
Let's not forget, if he's reelected, that's the ultimate.
Uh-huh.
Okay, anyway, we're almost out of time. So what do you think FDR would be thinking if he was watching this unfold?
Well, I mean, I think he would support all of us here at the table. I think he would agree with Sam that this has been that Trump's election and the trajectory he's on is a policy nightmare, right? But I think Roosevelt, the political strategist, would see that Trump is doing something that defied expectations, that has the possibility, if some of these things on the list transpire, to remake the Republican Party. I mean, you know, the things that Trump ran on were a big shift for the Republican Party, and putting into one party contradictory coalition, which is something that FDR was the master at. So there would be part of him that I think would sort of appreciate whether Trump is the mastermind behind this or not. The consequence is, for the moment, he's in the Oval Office.
Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up our episode. Thanks again, Meg, for joining us. I'll see you later.
True.
And thanks to everyone else for joining us. And Sam and I will be back on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody.
See ya.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.